Hello, welcome to Wheat from the Chaff. I'm Finn Locustane, the editor-in-chief of 8.9.com.
And I'm Phil Carson, the head of UK policy for the Nature Friendly Farming Network.
And later today, we're going to be joined by a special guest, a practical regenerative farming specialist, Niels Caulfield, who's going to be talking about how to deliver a weatherproof farm. So I'm looking forward to that. But first up, let's talk about liver fluke, Phil. This is an article that appeared on the site last week, commissioned by us, by Elena Boddy, who is from the George Farm Vets and Vet Sustain. And the article is called Fluke Control and Prevention Beyond Testing and Treatment. And she says parasites are an increasing burden upon livestock. Stock farming across all of the UK through increasing anthelmintic resistance plus changing epidemiology attributed to climate change. Liver fluke infection costs UK agriculture around £300 million a year, not to mention the impact on animal health and welfare. And she says that lots of discussion around fluke control is centred around testing and treatment options. And she asks the question, can we help to manage the disease by changing the way that we manage grazing land? And of course, the answer is yes. And there's an article, as I said, on the site, but also a video TV interview that I did with Elena. And of course, fluke is highly problematic. It's an increasing problem around the UK, particularly in the West. Lots and lots of farmers still relying on testing and treatment as their way of managing this. And a lot of vets still relying on that too, still pushing this idea of testing and treatment rather than thinking about land management. And just to give you an anecdote here at the sort of extreme end, there was a farmer that I knew in Scotland who was lamenting to me that over the course of the spring and summer season that he'd had that year, he had treated his sheep five times for liver fluke, and yet he still had a big problem. And of course, the problem partly was that he wasn't managing his land well, but also that having treated the sheep, he was then immediately putting them back out onto exactly the same pasture where they were picking up the liver fluke again. And I think before we sort of go into this and how we can manage land differently, it might be worth just very briefly talking through the liver fluke cycle. So you have eggs that come out of the livestock in the livestock feces. These then hatch and swim out to find the mud snail, which is the host. They then attach themselves to that mud snail for about 6 weeks, and then they come off the mud snail onto grasses where they insist, where the livestock are eating them. And at that point, of course, those fluke travel to the liver, and then the eggs get released about 3 months later into the feces, and that cycle begins all over again. It can be incredibly damaging. It has enormous impacts, particularly on sheep health and welfare. It can have impacts on bovine health and welfare as well. It can complicate tuberculosis testing, for example, in cattle. So the question is, how can we address it?
Yes, and this piece was fascinating to read. Really, really interesting. And yeah, kind of makes the point that quite often, as you described, Finlow, we can treat the symptom of something as opposed to looking at, I suppose, the root cause and some of those solutions that are a bit more holistic in nature, and look at the overarching management. And what I found within this that was key was the emphasis on regenerative farming as being one of the really crucial solutions within this. So say, for example, in terms of grazing management, making sure there's not access to bare soil, for example, really, really, really key within this, keeping the soil covered so there's not access for livestock to come into contact with infected snails, for example. The other thing within this I think is really key is just the need to act and the need to act now. And towards the end of this bit of work, it mentions the fact that we're going to be experiencing higher rainfall, increasingly different weather conditions, so hotter, wetter, more mild, which means that, liver fluke is going to be a more likely proposition than it is now. Already, it's already quite a big proposition. And then also just the idea of resistance to the chemical control that we do use. So this is not a given that you're always going to have that solution. So rather than it being the first step that you turn to whenever you come with these issues, it's advocating for something that tries to prevent in the first instance.
And you mentioned the mud snail there. And of course, that is the centrepiece in that life cycle that I described earlier on. And that seems to me to be the big opportunity. It's about how can we change the habitats that the mud snail enjoys in order to reduce the prevalence of that mud snail, because that is the essential host that brings the baby liver flukes through from that sort of just hatching stage up to the point at which they can get onto the grass and insist. And that is, as you were saying, it's about managing water in the landscape as much as anything. So removing opportunities for congregating animals. So making sure that if you've got water troughs, for example, that those, if at all possible, can be moved around so that you're not getting loads of compaction and poaching around those and you're feeding as well. And of course, as you say, regenerative agriculture provides that opportunity. And also reducing overgrazing through management. And Niels is going to be talking about the impact of overgrazing and the way that that stops water from being able to infiltrate a bit later in the programme.
On that point, the blog itself very strongly makes the case that set stocking could be contributing towards greater prevalence of parasite burden and liver fluke. And that could be, even if you've got low stocking rates, if you're having animals consistently going to the same place over and over and over again, they're more likely to come in contact with the parasite. The other thing that I thought was really key within this and really interesting, which you see, I suppose, in terms of recommendations around integrated pest management or parasite control, nature-based parasite control, was the beneficials within the system. And you spoke about the habitat management. The habitat management could be bringing in, say, for example, lapwings or song thrushes, things like that, which will predate upon the pest, and even some of the invertebrates which are in there as well that also provide that function. And it also makes the point that within that, if you're using anthelmintics, for example, potentially for another parasite, to control another parasite, so it could be worm burden, things like that, again, that could be contributing to the loss of those beneficials. So it's this kind of, again, holistic. One piece is linked to various different things all at once.
And as you say, it seems sort of slightly counterintuitive when you're trying to deal with liver fluke by creating drier areas, by managing water in a different way, that actually one of the things that you can do, having fenced off some of those particularly wet areas that you're finding real trouble in dealing with, is to actually sort of enhance those wet areas, maybe create ponds and those sorts of habitats where the liver fluke may flourish more, but at the same time, you're bringing in those predatory creatures, whether they're sort of birds or amphibians or other creatures that want to predate on the snail, and the impact of those predators, of course, will move out beyond the pond that you've created and those wet areas that you've created, but also trees and hedges. So this was another thing that farmer that I was mentioning earlier on was convinced that he needed to get rid of his hedges and trees because they were exacerbating his water problem rather than actually they helped to draw up water and to minimise the water, but also they create shade, and apparently mud snails prefer sunlight. And the other thing that you touched on there was that minimising of treatment, because the anthelmintics will be killing off not only the flukes and other worm burdens, but also those other invertebrates in the soil. And of course, the soil needs those invertebrates to give it good soil structure, again, allowing greater, better infiltration. So obviously, testing and treatment is still going to be necessary as you go forwards, because you need to make sure that you're on top of this. But you can greatly reduce the prevalence and the impact, both financially and in terms of the animal health and welfare impacts, by changing the way that you manage land.
Okay, the next one which I'm going to cover is the fact that River Action are taking the government to court over the escalating pollution issues that we're seeing within the River Wye. And this piece on the site focuses on the fact that River Action are taking both the Environment Agency and EFRA to court in the form of a judicial review, based on the belief that the Environment Agency are failing to enforce really important environmental regulations, and principally the farming rules for water. And in doing so, they've acted unlawfully, failing to protect special areas of conservation on the River Wye, and yet ultimately leading to its ecological collapse. So this took place last week, and it was outside Cardiff Civil Justice Centre, where there was a range of people kind of gathered to bring these proceedings to a head. And Charles Watson, who is the chair and founder of River Action, Commission had this to say. So the agonizing death of the River Wye has unfolded in recent years like a car crash in slow motion. The magnificent watercourse, so often voted our country's most loved river, has in recent years been assaulted by a deluge of pollution from intensive agriculture, causing prolonged algal blooms. He then goes on to say a major cause for this is the recent exponential growth of intensive poultry production within the catchment of the Wye, which supplies millions of chickens a week to the nation's leading supermarket retailer, Tesco. So the blame being put on the supply chain there. At any one time, there are as many as 24 million birds raised in the Wye Valley, approximately a quarter of the country's total poultry production. Very much the blame being laid on the regulatory agencies for not acting to enforce, I suppose, basic regulation to avoid the issues here. And I suppose he goes on to say that if these regulations were being enforced effectively, we wouldn't see this proliferation of poultry houses all within the catchment, and with that, the risks to the environment as well.
And historically, it seems that there's been a huge lack of joined up thinking between different planning authorities. So one planning authority allows, you know, one enormous chicken farm, another planning authority on the other side of the river allows another one allows another, and it just escalates, and there hasn't been that sort of conversation between planning authorities. And the Telegraph over the weekend actually was putting the pollution in the River Wye at something like three quarters from livestock feces, and of course cattle and sheep have been along the Wye for decades and decades and decades. The thing that's changed is the chicken feces pollution that's going in there. And if the term ecosystem collapse, you know, that was used in relation to this article might seem a bit overblown and over the top, there was an article on The Guardian just this morning talking about the fact that ecosystem collapse may already have happened at Loch Ness in Northern Ireland, where last year there was an enormous blue-green algae bloom, which is still present just underneath the surface. And the thing that the article was picking up was that normally at this time of the year, there is an absolute sort of fly monsoon going on around the shores of Loch Ness. And, you know, they were talking about the way in which you put your washing out and it's just covered in flies. But this year, there's hardly a fly there. And so this ecosystem has just stopped functioning. And of course, all those flies, much as they're annoying for human beings, are essential for feeding birds, fish, amphibians, invertebrates of all kinds. And at the same time, there's this zebra mussel, this invasive species epidemic there as well. And the fear of another blue-green algae bloom later on this year.
You bring Loch Ness into it, and I suppose it's demonstrative of the fact that what's happening in the Wye is not an isolated issue between Wales and England, for example, but issues with water quality are systemic. They're being experienced across all freshwater ecosystems, or the vast majority of them within the UK, and it needs a systemic response to address them. The other thing I think within this is obviously there's been an economic drive to increase agricultural production or forms of agricultural production along the river catchments. And I suppose in Loch Ness, that's a result of, I suppose, a massive push for agricultural increases in agricultural output and growth of the industry. And there's a perceived economic benefit of doing that. But you mentioned Loch Ness. I'm sure the situation in the Wye is similar. There's lots of other businesses that require fresh water and healthy freshwater ecosystems to thrive and to prosper. And some of those are going by the wayside and actually failing as a result of this. We've seen in Loch Ness, there's been fisheries going out of business. We've seen recreation activities and organisations that support those are very, very concerned about the situation. So we really do need to see these things being addressed. And I think this is a bit of a landmark. What's happening in the Wye is a judicial review. If it's upheld and there's action as a result of it, then I think it might be the first of many.
Number three, the third story we have today is First Milk and BV Dairy. So First Milk announces the acquisition of BV Dairy. And this is really interesting because First Milk describes itself as the UK's first regenerative dairy. And the way that they back that up is that they have built in a whole range of regenerative outcomes that they expect from their farmers. There's been a small premium that they pay farmers who are delivering those regenerative outcomes. And that's been in place since 2021. And more than 90% of their farmers are working to those regenerative principles, which is 96% of their volume. And they are essentially a liquid milk commodity producer. They are Nestlé, for example, is the biggest UK customer for First Milk. And they've now brought in or acquired BV Dairy, which works to the catering and the food service. So it's a really nice combination of different elements of the dairy trade coming together there. And I like this story in particular because BV Dairy is set up in the next village to me, across in Dorset, across in Fontmell Magna. Carolina, and all of the farms that are servicing BV Dairy are currently within 30 miles of Fontmell. So that's really good. And the other things, First Milk have done this. It's worth just having a look at some of the other things that they're doing, because people talk about regenerative agriculture and we tend to think of it as being something that, you know, smaller producers or direct sales are doing. But actually, First Milk are doing so much. And they have a new partnership with Yo Valley, the Naturally Better Dairy Group. And they also have Golden Hooves, which is their sort of consumer-facing regenerative cheese brand. And they say on their website that they aren't trying just simply to be less bad. They are trying to deliver positive regenerative outcomes. Now, we obviously have the article on the website, but we also have a film where I went out and interviewed a number of key stakeholders, both from First Milk and BV Dairy, senior figures. And if people are interested in hearing more about that acquisition and what it means, then just go to 8.9 and you'll be able to find that. If you're looking on a desktop, look to the right. If you're looking on a mobile, scroll down. And hopefully we'll be getting somebody from First Milk to come and talk about their approach to regenerative dairy on Wheat from the Chaff very soon as well. Phil, number four.
Yes, from a very positive story to one which is a cause for concern. And this centres on cost of living and the cost of living crisis causing loneliness for young people. So this was a piece of work polling undertaken by FairShare and led by YouGov. And it shows that almost half of 18 to 24 year olds in the UK are cutting back and socialising with friends due to the cost of living crisis. It demonstrates that concerns around food security and household food security and the cost of living are meaning that, I suppose basic needs in terms of socialising with people to improve mental health, to have that connection with others, are falling by the wayside. So not only that first statistic, but the survey also shows that over half of 25 to 34 year olds, so I fall within that bracket, so I assume that I'm still considered a young person, will avoid...
I know that when we talked about this before, you really wanted to get across the fact that you're still a young person, and I'm not.
Yeah, exactly, and I had to just focus on this, and also I'm just 34, so I've still got 1 year of
yeah, and then young... it's all downhill, mate, all downhill.
Yeah, so 52% of 25 to 34-year-olds will avoid meeting friends this year, as rising costs add to the rising rate of loneliness in the UK. And that's a pretty stark figure when you think about it. Over the course of the whole year, avoiding meeting friends, which we know is absolutely crucial in terms of creating connection with people. So FairShare do make the point that they are there and trying to address some of these issues by providing access to food for people in need of it. And they're calling for a redistribution of waste food as well to people as well, which is really important and can play a role in addressing some of these issues.
And of course, the impact here is felt in many different directions at once, isn't it? Obviously, it's an enormous impact on a whole generation of young people. And not only that impact now, but those trends, those expectations, the way that people live their lives going forward. And you've got the impact on those individuals in terms of not being able to eat well in the first place, having to make those cuts, and potentially the impacts therefore on health services, on the NHS, and those, again, those are impacts that will cascade over time, potentially, if those eating habits continue, but also impacts on the hospitality sector, including restaurants, and the amount of food that people are eating out of home. So there's an economic impact on the hospitality sector at the same time as having this, you know, this impact on society in terms of those individuals themselves. So it's a really important one. Shall we go on to BNG? This is potentially a good news story. Biodiversity net gain. New housing developments to deliver a boost for nature in landmark move. So from Monday the 12th of February, all major housing developments are required to deliver at least 10% benefit for nature, with England becoming the first country in the world to make biodiversity net gain a legal requirement. It means that developers in England are now legally required to deliver at least a 10% increase in biodiversity when major building projects are undertaken. And to put that into context, a major building project in this definition is 10 or more dwellings. And then from April the 2nd, developments underneath that scale, so 1 to 9 dwellings, will have to deliver that biodiversity net gain as well. And it's starting at 10%. There is evidence that one or two councils are starting to look for 20% biodiversity net gain, which is good, but it still remains to be seen, I think, just how effective this is. I can understand that there may be habitats that you can damage through development and then recreate fairly close by or further afield if there isn't any availability close by. But there are also habitats that are replaceable. And this always concerned me around HS2 when they were talking about biodiversity net gain in relation to the destruction of ancient woodlands. An ancient woodland is an irreplaceable habitat. Old ancient floodplains, grasslands, these are irreplaceable habitats. And so I think we need to wait and see whether the rhetoric around biodiversity net gain actually plays out. And just anecdotally, I was at Turnworth Down in Dorset over the course of the weekend with my son's Eco Kids group, and we were talking to the grazier who manages that land and some other people from the National Trust who had helped to set up that particular event. And up there, you've got, up on top of the down, an Iron Age village with lots of bumpy ground, the archaeology that's still present there, that the National Trust had bought this particular piece of land to ensure that some of the ploughing that had started in the environment around it didn't encroach upon that that archaeology. And so now, within an area which is managed in the way that you would expect farming to be managed, that there are some bits that are more intensive than others, other bits that are more extensive than others, but here at Turnworth you have over 1,000 years worth of archaeology that's there. And of course, because you've got that archaeology that's present, you've also got 1,000 years of seed bank and 1,000 years of biodiversity being built up. And I'm sorry, but nobody can tell me that you could build there and then somehow recreate that in an instant, even over the course of 30 years. That is an irreplaceable habitat. And at the same time, we had an article that we put on the website today, which was showcasing some comments from conservation expert Miles King, who was talking about the massive inconsistency that now exists after 6 weeks ago, the government suddenly recognised, in terms of the payments to farmers, that ancient grasslands, that species-rich grasslands were really important, and increased those payments per hectare from around £150, wasn't it, to something like £670. But at the same time, they refused to accept that grasslands can be irreplaceable in terms of biodiversity net gain. Miles said when they launched biodiversity net gain, they sounded a death knell for the same wildlife and history-rich ancient grasslands that were being protected now within the Elms payments, and they refused to accept this. DEFRA refused to accept that grasslands can be irreplaceable within the BNG rules. Grasslands, however old, however species rich, however full of history and meaning, can be destroyed and replaced elsewhere in a location more convenient for house builders. And Phil, I mean, the only thing I can think is that one arm of DEFRA simply hasn't caught up with another arm of DEFRA, and we can only hope that they will.
Yeah, I think for biodiversity net gain as a principle to be successful, the scheme has to work, but we need to have sufficient planning processes put in place to provide that protection and avoid against harm of habitats that, as you say, can't be recreated or moved elsewhere. And I think there needs to be both sides of that brought into the equation here for this to actually be effective. How can you actually calculate the value and the quantity of species-rich grassland versus newly planted woodland? You can't do it. So I think we need to see the guidance in that kind of reflecting those things. I would say, though, there's a big opportunity in terms of biodiversity net gain for farmers, because there's going to be a need to compensate for the potential losses in urban areas or where house building is taking place. And that funding and that resourcing can, I suppose, be directed towards land management to deliver some really, really good stuff. So we'll hope to see that moving on and actually delivering and helping to fund farmers to do some really good stuff in their land.
Fantastic. Let's take a break. And we're back, and we're joined by Niels Caulfield, who's a regenerative farming expert and a farming consultant and trainer. And we're going to be talking about his concept of a weatherproof farm, about the impact of overgrazing, and about why we get flooding. So, Niels, perhaps you could just sort of introduce yourself. Tell us what it is you do.
Thanks for your note. So, yeah, as you said, I work as an independent farming advisor and trainer. So part of that work is delivering talks to farming clusters, for example, around the country, and working otherwise with individuals and groups, you know, through consultancy, and doing sort of monitoring work, you know, monitoring soils and pastures directly. And sort of part of that work sort of led me to, now have monitored over 200 farms right across the UK.
I just wanted to touch on the fact you've got this new program, the Weatherproof Farm, and it seems to be running very successfully. Would you be able to describe what you mean by that?
Yeah, so essentially, in this case, we're sort of focusing the grazing context, but that, you know, there is sort of an arable aspect to it. But in this instance, the kind of bottom line here is that sort of adopting a different set of practices can significantly reduce housing periods and therefore essential housing costs associated with sort of wet ground conditions. And we can also significantly increase grass production, both on average, but also during sort of dry periods. And essentially sort of those sort of drought periods should be the sort of our biggest yield in terms of forage rather than our least.
I wonder if you could talk us through water and the journey of water, Niels, because one of the things that seems to me that's at the centre of regenerative agriculture is the way that water infiltrates, or indeed the way that water runs off. And there are big impacts on the farm itself, but also big impacts on society. What allows water to infiltrate? And indeed, perhaps more importantly, what stops it from infiltrating?
Yeah, so essentially what we're talking about here is the small water cycle, sort of in a nutshell. Contrary to popular belief, you know, the kind of rain doesn't fall mostly on the plain, it mostly falls on the high ground. But essentially, you know, the rain falls on the ground and the soil covers all of the ground, with the exception of very small areas of sort of like rocky outcrop. And then it can sort of take one of two paths. It can either infiltrate or run off. And essentially, soils that are healthy have good aggregate structure. And they have sponge structure. In other words, they have porosity, which allows water to percolate through and into the medium, a little bit like sort of coffee does into coffee grounds. However, if the soils are dense, blocky, or in old money, compacted, there's no air spaces, there's no porosity, basically, there's no place for the water to go to. So all it can do is run off.
And what causes that compaction?
Yeah, so essentially through our monitoring work, looking at infiltration rate tests and spade tests on farm, which are benchmarked between sort of infield areas and areas that you might call out of management, you know, sort of a verge, a hedge, next to the fence, over the fence, etc., we're able to establish that essentially it's management that is the key sort of driving factor. You know, in those tests, essentially, we're looking at the same soil type, the same underlying geology, the same climate. So what does that leave us with? It leaves us with management as the primary cause of these soil structure, soil health issues.
And what does that mean? Where, how does management create that compaction in the soil? Is it simply from, you know, tractors driving around, from livestock spending too long on a particular piece of ground and their hooves kind of creating that compaction, or is it something else?
Essentially, what we sort of see in terms of the correlations between the sort of monitoring work that we do, essentially where we do our spade tests, and you kind of visually evidence what's going on below ground against your infiltration rate, what we see is that good aggregate structure, good crumb structure correlates closely with rooting density, or in other words, dense roots. So essentially where you have a turf, where the sort of roots intermingle basically and form a, you know, a mat, that's where you see this aggregate structure, that's where you see the infiltration. So essentially, we can say that sort of in a nutshell, infiltration is tracking closely with rooting density.
And when we were speaking before, I was really struck by the way that you talked about the impact of grazing and overgrazing and what that does to the grass plant and what it does to the roots, and the way that when you get overgrazing, essentially what you're doing on the hillside is creating an environment that is very much the same as a bowling green. If you're trying to create a bowling green, you mow it and you mow it and you mow it and you create that really thick but thin layer of turf that gives you that sort of perfect layer to run your bowling balls across, and you get a similar impact on the hillside.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's sort of, you know, certainly this applies to sort of hill grazing, but it's also kind of relevant in sort of in-by ground and lowland grazing situations. But essentially what's happening where animals have extended access to grazing in a field or an area, basically in a sort of set stocking or continuous grazing situation, animals have, like I say, sort of continued or extended access to those grass plants, which means that they will have access to grasses or individual grass plants that are regrowing. So, you know, you imagine when you turn animals into the pasture on day one, they all sort of fan out and sort of, you know, mooch about and identify the sort of the sweetest, most tasty grasses they can get their hands on, and they'll take them right down. So we'll get good, you know, good utilization with them basically. And gradually they'll sort of like they move on to the less and less palatable plants until you get around to sort of, let's say, day three, day four, depending on the time of year. And that from that point onwards, basically, there will be regrowth on those plants that were bitten on day one, which those animals will preferentially select, because essentially you're just building up sort of areas of rejection, a sort of plane of rejection within the pasture in that situation. And in that situation where they have where they take the second bite, as it's called, what you're effectively doing is eating the roots, because the energy to grow that regrowth comes from the roots. It's exchanged into the leaf, and the leaf is then removed by the animal, basically. Because at this point, the plants aren't really photosynthesizing. They don't have enough leaf area really to photosynthesize. So the point here is that essentially the plants are being under-rested. That's a better term to use than overgrazing, because essentially this can happen with one animal, 100 animals, for example, you know, who all seen that sort of one horse sort of patrolling around, basically looking for fresh bite, basically. So essentially it's a product of time, not of numbers. And the kind of take home message here is that when animals take that second bite, or often third or fourth bite, what happens is that it causes the plant to size down. Essentially you're bonsaiing those plants in the same way that you bonsai trees through a pruning regime that turns an oak tree that would grow, what, sort of 50 foot, for example, into this sort of 2 foot tall, you know, diminutive specimen, basically. And that's all through management, essentially.
Within that as well, so you're talking about management, and some of the changes in management that you're advocating for are quite significant for some farmers. And you have been doing workshops with farmers across the entirety of the UK, and emphasizing that it's not necessarily soil type, it's management. There's lots of solutions here available for you to, I suppose, to put forward in your farm. Generally, in your experience, how readily adopted or understood are those kind of principles and concepts? And what impact have you seen from people who've been on your courses kind of delivering some of the stuff you're advocating for?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's early days in lots of situations. And yeah, I mean, I certainly agree that sort of that idea that you would move animals, you know, frequently, you know, every few days or even every day, you know, definitely feels like, you know, sort of an insurmountable kind of hill, if you like, given the chronic lack of labour and time in most, if not all, kind of grazing operations. But I think there's a few things to point to there. And the first one, you know, is that, like, you know, we're not just ticking boxes here. We're not just looking for brownie points. You know, essentially making these changes will deliver on the bottom line. It will significantly increase grass production, because rather than your plants being stunted through being overgrazed, will significantly increase yield. And the way that I think about it or sort of offer is, you know, if you're working with groups, you know, put your hands up if you cut your silage every 7 days, no hands. Put your hands up if you cut your silage every 3 days, no hands. Why wouldn't you do that? You know, and generally we sort of go around the houses, but, you know, finally get to the point, well, you're not going to get such a good yield. You're always cutting at that sort of the end of the sort of vegetative stage to optimize the amount of dry matter that you are producing in any given period, basically. So in other words, you know, why would you let your animals do that if you wouldn't let the mower do that? You know, it's sort of, if we think about it in terms of bales, this is a pretty kind of no-brainer kind of situation, basically. But again, if we're keeping animals in paddock for extended periods, they're constantly sort of nipping off that yield every 3 days, sort of stopping it sort of getting beyond where it could be. But essentially, there's good evidence that shows that we can increase utilizable dry matter by 90%+. You know, that essentially represents a doubling in yield.
And you mentioned earlier reducing housing time, and I suppose weatherproof farm, and we were speaking earlier in the podcast about increasing kind of extreme weather events, but just, yeah, consistently warmer and wetter winters, for example. Do you think that the reduction in housing times is achievable with what's coming down the line?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, essentially, the healthier the soil is, the better the structure it is, the better it copes with extreme weather events, whether they be heavy rains or long periods of dry, because essentially, rather than the water getting arrested at the surface and creating this sort of like puggy, poachy, slimy, you know, kind of greasy kind of surface, basically, again, you've got that sort of sponge structure, basically. So it absorbs water, it allows water to pass through. And from that point onwards, it can then sort of, you know, enter groundwater and move away in a kind of sort of progressive and kind of safe manner, if you like. And that's what really sort of evens out those sort of flood pulses, if you like, basically. But essentially, it's that sponge structure that comes to the soil that means that, you know, when it rains, again, it's got the water's got somewhere to go rather than just sitting on the surface. And then sort of, you know, you flip that on its head, if you like, and then move to the sort of middle of the season where we're generally now dealing with deficiencies, if you like. We've got more water stored in the soil. So essentially, you want to think of the soil as a reservoir, but orders of magnitude larger than any sort of like farm scale lagoon or sort of water storage that you could imagine. You know, once you're talking about sort of 6 inches of soil being sort of like hydrated to what, you know, 30% or something like, for example, there's a huge reservoir for the plants to then draw upon when it does get warm and dry. And that's in that situation, we should be driving more growth. We should be, rather than sort of peaking and then dropping off quite radically, as it gets warm and dry, that heat and that sun should be continuing to drive growth, you know, into those dry periods above and beyond what we had before, but only if water isn't a limiting factor. So again, what we deliver through increased aggregation is better infiltration and better water holding capacity. So it's the best of both worlds.
Time, as ever, is against us, Niels, but I just want to ask you this one final question, which, if every farm in the UK, or at least the vast majority of farms, were farming regeneratively, would we have had the kind of flooding issues that we've had this winter after, you know, such a wet autumn and such a wet winter as we've had over the course of 2023-24 so far?
So in my opinion, the answer is no to that. And the reason why I say that is that, you know, the evidence from the on-farm infiltration rate tests that we do is that in general we see kind of like infiltration last taking hours, for example, if not sort of, you know, days to infiltrate an inch of water. And yet when you walk to the sort of the headland, well, not the headland necessarily, but, you know, sort of an area that's out of management that's within a few meters of this, 20, 30 meters, we can see orders of magnitude sort of 10 times or 100 times quicker, basically. So essentially there's a huge potential there. And, you know, the one thing that builds aggregate structure better than anything else is healthy grasses, vigorous, rapidly growing grasses. So essentially in that situation where we're passing water into the soil, now we're really evening out those flood pulses rather than it being really flashy and peaky, have much steadier rise in water flow, much more consistent. And the same, we should see that with land drains, for example. So they'll start to run later after a great heavy rain event, but they'll continue to run for longer, but more consistently. Yeah. So essentially what we're doing there is we're recharging groundwater, boreholes, open water storage, if you like, and we're evening out all of those flood pulses. Are we going to be completely eliminating flooding? Probably not, but the severity will go down significantly. I think that's the key point. And it, rather than it being these sort of short, sharp, quite intense sort of flash floods that, you know, sort of cause areas, you know, pinch points, normally hard infrastructure is the place that sort of really shows it up. We're taking away, let's say, 90% of the pressure from those hard infrastructure sort of choke points, basically.
Amazing. That's been so interesting. And perhaps, Niels, we can get you back at some point to talk about other details in relation to regenerative farming. Thank you so much for joining us. Let's take a break. We're back, and thanks so much again to Niels Caulfield for coming in. I found particularly fascinating that whole kind of Bowling Green analogy that I was pulling out, the way that, you know, as you overgraze the grass, you're also overgrazing the root, and you're just creating this thick sort of felt on top of the land where the water can't infiltrate and it just runs off. Look, the next story, the final story that we're talking about today is Labour pulls ahead in crucial battle for the countryside vote. And this is a story from a poll from the Country, Land and Business Association, the CLA, says the Conservatives are struggling to keep hold of their rural heartlands, suffering a 25-point collapse in support, according to a stark new poll that shows Labour pulling ahead in the crucial battle for the countryside vote. The share of the Labour vote has climbed to 37%, up 17 points on the 2019 general election, with the Conservatives falling to 34. More respondents, they say, believe that Labour understands and respects rural communities and the rural way of life than the Conservatives do. That's 28% versus 25%. That's quite a change, Phil.
Yeah, it's quite a monumental shift in, I suppose, voting intention and also kind of, where the parties are seen by voters in this area. You look at it from the perspective of what Labour have done, and I would say it's fair to say that they haven't necessarily put forward a compelling long-term vision for what for rural areas in terms of how land is managed, how they will support farming. The detail isn't quite there. Again, how they support rural economies as well. It's not a big picture vision that I think they put through. So that asks the question of why there's been that shift and that change. There's partly potentially many reasons within that, but there could be, I would say, generally they're reflecting shifts across society, and we're seeing big shifts in terms of a number of different areas and different seats that have moved from Conservative to Labour. And it's difficult for a party that's been in government for 13 years and is facing and has faced lots of different challenges all at the same time. And I think that's being reflected in some of these, just in terms of the difficult situation that many people in rural and urban areas alike are finding themselves in.
I think that's key, isn't it? That, you know, people aren't just sort of divided by whether they live in a rural area or an urban area. And a lot of the things that people are experiencing in urban areas are actually things that people are experiencing in rural areas as well. There has been, you know, an increase in rural poverty. Rural economies are struggling, where you have ever larger farms that aren't necessarily connected to the villages or the towns that they're serving in terms of the food that's being produced. And obviously, you know, we keep talking about an awful lot of the good work that's going on within agroecology and regenerative agriculture and those direct supply chains, but they're still relatively few and far between in comparison with that sort of broader picture. And sometimes the only contact that people in a rural village might have with agriculture is seeing sort of ever bigger tractors kind of rumbling through the villages at relative speed. But I wonder as well if there's a general generational issue. And I remember when I was living in the Fens, my neighbour who retired from agricultural work at about the age of 70, I think she was 69 when she got run over by a tractor and broke her leg. And, you know, she had fantastic stories about going out picking leeks with sort of yard-long icicles on the bottom of these leeks as she was pulling them out of the ground and hitting them with a mallet to get the icicles off. I mean, you know, hard, back-breaking work. But she would tell stories about how in previous generations, the farmer would just stick a sign up on a post which told people who they were supposed to vote for on election day, and the expectation was that you would or else you'd lose your job. And I don't think that happens, you know, to any great extent anymore. And so there is this generational change. People are generally more aware, they're more connected. The kind of news stories that people read in rural areas is the same as they're reading elsewhere. And there is, of course, this general story that's taking place at the moment. There is this endemic decline of people just being fed up with their life chances not being as good as they want them to be.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. And we probably do see more diverse rural communities in many respects. You've probably seen people moving in to the countryside from urban areas. Like, as a trend, we've probably seen rural depopulation across Europe, but you're also starting to see people moving to rural areas, people going and studying at university, for example, working in other professions, coming back to the farm or coming back to the town they grew up in. You see that. And with that, that brings differences in perspective and not that kind of cast iron certainty that people will vote in a certain way. I think those are all elements within this too. And yet you can't overlook, again, it's a very difficult situation for many people. We are seeing, I would say, a general sense of fatigue with how things are at the moment. And we've been through COVID, we've been through an energy crisis, all sorts of things like that. And those are manifesting in different ways in the countryside as well, and obviously having an impact on people's intentions and who they're going to vote for. I think within this too, what I would say is we haven't really seen any party put forward a compelling or coherent vision for what farming and land use needs to look like, or a vision for the countryside as well. I would say between the Conservatives and Labour, we haven't necessarily got that. I think the Liberal Democrats are very much focusing on rural issues, but in an isolated way and in particular constituencies, as opposed to this vision for what the countryside needs to look at, like to meet a range of different objectives. So I really think there's a need to fill that gap. Whether we'll see that in time before the next general election is to be seen.
There's a need, isn't there, to really envision what a rural economy looks like, what a thriving rural economy looks like. And within that, you need to address poverty. You need to address public transport, which at the moment is sparse and expensive. At the same time, you need to make sure that the schools are inspiring places to be. I think rural schools find it much harder to recruit really good teachers. And of course, there is, across the country, poor access to healthcare. And if you're living in rural areas, then that access to healthcare is even harder. And jobs are few and far between very often. And if you don't drive and you're living in a rural area, you've got to go a long way. So there are lots of social issues that need to be there. And I think you're right that there is this need for a compelling vision. And that vision isn't being manifested by any of the major political parties. It is being dealt with piecemeal. But at the same time, the Conservatives, probably more than any other recent government over the last few years, have been focused, because of leaving the European Union, because of having to redefine the Common Agricultural Policy, they have been focused on farming. They have been having this great big conversation about the shape of the countryside. They have been bringing in new legislation around nature and biodiversity net gain, as we were talking about before. It's just a question of whether people genuinely believe it or not.
Or if it's joined up and everything that they bring forward in terms of policy and legislation contributes towards that vision. So on one side of it, where we have a transition to public money and public goods, we have a really, in principle, bold future for agriculture that works hand in hand with the environment and produces food in ways which are sustainable, which are healthy for people, which is a very positive and compelling vision to have. But that needs to be underpinned by a trade policy which doesn't subject farmers to competition from imports that don't meet the standards that we have at home, for example, and a supply chain that actually pays its fair share within that transition as well. So you need all parts working together to achieve the vision. I think within this as well is, where does rural development fit and that investment in place? And I think it's fair to say that the level of investment in that element of a transition probably hasn't been sufficient. And I think that's a point that's been made within this piece of polling and the associated article attached to it from the CLA, which makes that point, I think. We need to look at the potential and bring in all of the pieces to realise it.
All really important issues, I think, there. And very interesting. It'll be interesting to see how the parties deal with this as the election draws nearer. Which makes me wonder, Phil, how the Nature Friendly Farming Network has been seeking to influence, as many other organisations will have been doing, the manifestos that are coming out of the political parties as the general election comes nearer.
From our perspective, we have focused very much on food and farming, as opposed to all rural issues in the round. But we have tried to draw that link between, I suppose, good rural development and linking up rural development with farming and land management, because I think both of those things are absolutely crucial. I think what we've been looking at is the timeline and the time frame in which manifestos are going to be drawn up and developed. And some parties are ahead of others within that process. So we saw back in September time at the Liberal Democrats conference, they debated and then agreed upon their kind of prospectus and manifesto asks for food and farming, but also the environment as well. So how those are linked up. And within that, they have made a commitment or made a call for an increased budget up to £4 billion compared to what we would have had before, which was 3.2. So they've already set out their stall and moved on that quite quickly. It's a case of engaging with key members within the party who can influence that process, but also the people who are tasked with writing manifestos as well. And I know that you in a previous life have have done some of that work before. Again, we've seen recently that Labour, they're very much in the process of developing their manifesto. And it was the start of February time that that process, I suppose, reached its zenith. And was that process of engagement with external organisations to actually influence what comes out there has been finished. And again, that's been advocacy and inside track advocacy with key people within the party, but also those advisors that work with the shadow team within DEFRA as well. Conservative side of the house as well, we want to work with organisations like Conservative Environment Network, which are very, very important in terms of shaping what their future vision for food, farming and the environment looks like as well. And they've recently come out and published their manifesto ask within that too. So it's about identifying those that have influence and trying to make a compelling and cogent argument as to why things should be in there. One of the things that we have done is to look at polling ourselves and trying to demonstrate that public want and public desire for policies that actually deliver for food production, but also for nature and climate as well.
I wonder about the level of detail that manifestos tend to go into. And I've read a lot of manifestos over the course of my 50 years. Not that I was reading them in the pram, but, you know, I've been looking at them for a long time. And my instinct is that they have become thinner over the course of the last couple of decades. Sometimes the language is perhaps a bit visionary, a bit flowery, but the level of detail is relatively small. I mean, there have been manifestos in the past which have been, on all sides, which have been really very, very detailed. Do you get the impression that, what you're trying to do at the moment with the political parties in the run-up to the 2024 UK general election is to influence a trajectory, a direction of travel, rather than specifics around the detail of nature restoration or farm payments?
Yeah, it's a vision. It's a vision, and it's making the business case to invest in that vision. The technical policy detail in terms of how that is implemented, by and large, won't find its way into a manifesto. I think for many reasons, partly a party doesn't want to tie itself down too tightly to any particular commitments. And the more detail that you put into that, the less wriggle room you have to get out of them. So I think there's an element of that. And also just the nature of the beast, these things can change very, very quickly. And we could be faced with all sorts of crises in government, all sorts of other priorities that come out of nowhere. So I think there's an element of trying to keep yourselves open on that front. So for ourselves, whenever we've developed our manifesto asks, again, those have been quite high level, quite easy in terms of being able to put them in four very, very simple, very small points. And then the more detailed technical stuff comes after that.
The final area that I thought it would be useful to cover is just what 8.9 plans to do around the general election and land use. And obviously with 8.9, our brief is quite large. It's not just farming for food, it's farming for food and fibre and forestry and natural capital, a whole range of different things. Crucially, we are an independent news channel. We're not aligned to any particular political party. And so what we're hoping to do is to interview key people from as many different political party teams as we can manage to get onto different programs. But what we're planning to do as well is to build a matrix which is available to people consistently throughout the period, where people will be able to click on the matrix and see different political parties and against different questions, different issues associated with the countryside and land use, and the way that these manifestos, as they come out, the way that they deal with these particular issues. And again, we'll try not to provide commentary on top of this. It'll just be pulling out, what the parties have said, if they've said anything at all on issue X, Y, or Z. And I think it's really important to try and provide some of that independent sort of wrapping up of where the parties are on key issues. Because certainly I saw, there was an article that went out recently from, a big land agent in the UK that did the rounds on social media, particularly around LinkedIn. And I won't say who it was that put the article out, but it was comparing different party policies. And I thought, I have to say, that it was quite lazy and that it obviously slanted Conservative. It made a lot of assumptions and it mischaracterised the positions of other parties. And I think that, there is going to be a lot of that sort of thing happening in the run-up to the election. So what I'm hoping is that we will be able to be a repository of independent thoughts, essentially written by those political parties themselves, accurately representing what they've said in their manifestos. So We'll try and be more forensic as we go forward. The question is, I suppose, which parties should we cover? And obviously it's the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, the Liberal Democrats and the Greens. But then, you know, do we cover Reform UK? Possibly, we probably need to. And then it's fairly straightforward to cover Plaid Cymru and the SNP. When we get over to Northern Ireland, Phil, who do we cover in Northern Ireland? There are a lot of parties there.
Yeah, there's a lot. You'd have to cover probably six or seven. So by the end of this process, you're probably sitting at about 18 to 20 different political parties that you have to keep track of.
That's an awful lot. I mean, we're not going to be covering the Monster Raving Loony Party, I have to say. So do we really need to cover six or seven in Northern Ireland? Can we not narrow it down to two or three?
Oh, whenever you're in a system of mandatory coalition and proportional representation, I think you do, Finlow. I think you do.
Okay, right. Well, we've got our work set out, haven't we? Well, I think that probably wraps it up for today, Phil. What do you think?
Yeah, sounds good to me.
Well, in that case, thanks again to Niels Caulfield. Really great. Grateful to him for his time today. Next week, we're going to be talking to forestry expert Andrew Heald, so I'm looking forward to that. And for today, I've been Finlow Castain, and it's bye from me.
And I've been Phil Carson. Goodbye.